Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, the Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Sting stories right after this. You know, we Americans may hold the dubious honor of being the most litigious people in the world, but when it comes to law, we seem to be among the world's most ignorant. Today, most Americans feel powerless to resist the evils that they see perpetrated against our liberties, our privacy, and our property by these powerful government agencies and multinational corporations, the lobbies, and the news media. But you know, we don't have to remain helpless. The institution designed by God and incorporated into our Constitution and Bill of Rights is called the judicial power. Now, the courts are the proper repository for the protection of our rights, our liberties, and our property. That's not in the Congress, and it's not in our political process. Now, did you know, for instance, that the privilege against self-incrimination is neither accorded to the passive resistant nor to the person who is ignorant of his rights, not to someone who is indifferent thereto? And that's because it's a fighting clause, and its benefits can be retained only by sustained combat, and it cannot be claimed by an attorney or a solicitor. And it is valid only when insisted upon by a belligerent claimant in person. So says U.S. versus Johnson. Now, that's why I contend that we should listen more to our judges and less to our politicians and lawyers. Now, did you hear what that judge said in that statement? He said, "Your rights cannot be claimed by your attorney or solicitor. Your rights can only be claimed by you, the belligerent claimant, in person." Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package while you're at it. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school, and it's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and it's free. That's the place to start. Doesn't cost anything. Courtroom Strategy and Procedure is available. That's our school on compact disc for adult home education. Now, if you're online, why don't you go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Then click on to our archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. That's georgegordon.org. All right, we're talking about stings. Now, remember, a sting is a test of a law, custom, usage, practice that's being used or utilized in your local community. And what we're trying to learn how to do here is, what do you do, or how do you correct systemic violations of rights by police and public officials in your local area? I'm not talking about, you know, how do we redo the Civil Rights Act of 1964. That's a congressional thing. That's political. But what do you do at the local level when you have a problem with local police or public officials who are violating your rights, and we want to make some corrections here? And the judicial process is the process that's set to do just that. In fact, the courts are there to protect the rights and interests of individuals. The political process is there to protect the rights and interests of the majority. So when you are a minority and the majority is trampling upon your rights, then the place to go for a correction is into the judicial arena. That's what they're there for. Now, remember in the last program, I wanted to raise an issue at Article 1, Section 9 of our Constitution that relates to stopping, entering, clearing, and paying duties in a port of entry. And in Idaho, that statute was located at Chapter 49, Section 2927. After having made that challenge, the jury came back with a guilty verdict. Just exactly what the judge predicted did occur. Now, later, I won that case on appeal on a collateral issue called the counsel issue. Now, I'm not going to get into the counsel issue at this juncture of time. That's a story for another time and another place. But for the purposes of our discussion here today, I lost round one. But I walked out of the judge's chambers that day armed with the knowledge of the correct legal issue. That we're not here to argue about Article 1, Section 9. We're here to argue about whether this truck is loaded or empty. Or if the truck is it loaded with something that's on the list? Now, with that information between my ears, we went back to the drawing boards. And we came up with a plan. This time we wanted to test the issue. We're going to test it at the same scale. And as it turned out, with the same actors. And it was about a month later that we got the thing done, and we said, well, now we've got to show that this truck is empty. Well, the truck has to be empty, but we have to make the police believe that the truck is loaded. Now, how are we going to do that? Well, the first thing we had to do is to make sure that they couldn't look inside the truck. You know, if you can just open the door and look inside, you can see the truck is empty. And that isn't going to help our cause any. So the back doors, it was a van-type truck. And we're not talking about a flatbed here. You know, it's got a van on it. And you can't just look inside here. And so the truck has to be empty to comply with the law. And the truck has to appear to be loaded, but we want to make sure that the truck is empty, and we have to be able to produce witnesses, evidence, and testimony as to that fact. So, to prevent the police from looking inside, there was a strip of rubber on the back door that had been ripped off down at the bottom. And, you know, you could just look through the crack in the door inside and see that this truck didn't have anything in it. And if the policeman was to look inside, see that the truck was empty, and then come in there and testify that the truck was empty and fail to stop, enter, clear, and pay duty in the port of entry, we would win our case, but in the process, we would be tipping our hand as to what the winning argument was. So we have two secrets to keep here. Number one, we want to keep secret the question of whether the truck is loaded or empty, and two, we want to keep secret the issue, the correct legal argument, which is it loaded or empty? Because the police don't know this. And when I say police, we're talking really about the prosecuting attorney. Policemen, per se, are not trained in the law. They're just there to do their job. It's the prosecutor that we're looking at here. All right, now, armed with that, we put a new rubber gasket on, sealed that up. And then we had some holes in the floor. It was a wooden floor, and, you know, there was cracks and there was knot holes in it. And if somebody had gotten underneath the truck, they could have looked up through those holes, and they might see that the truck was empty. So we went all over the floor of the truck, and we corrected those holes by nailing coffee can lids down over them. Next, there were some rivets that were out of the siding on the side of the truck, which, you know, conceivably you could look through those rivet holes, and so we sealed up all the rivet holes. Now the truck was 100% closed. Now it had a lock on the back, so we made sure we had a padlock on the back of the truck so that you'd have to cut the padlock off Now, remember, you have to have a search warrant to make these kinds of searches, and so this is going to be a Fourth Amendment issue. We're going to raise this to a Fifth Amendment issue so that we've got both Fourth and Fifth Amendment issues to raise as our federal question. That's assuming that we ever have to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. We have to set our federal issue at the scene of the crime. Next, we have to make the truck appear to be loaded. So we built a battlement up on top where we normally carried our six-drawer pedestals, and we covered that with a tarp. Now, it is true that if the police had put their minds to it, they could lift the straps and look under the tarp with or without our permission, and they would see that there was nothing up there. But, you know, you can't always have a perfect 100% sting operation, so we settled for the straps and the tarp. Now, next, we had to make sure that we could prove that this truck had never been loaded at any time in its voyage between Boise and Bliss. There was another town called Mountain Home, and in theory, we could load the truck in Boise, drive to Mountain Home and unload, which would put us in violation of the law, then drive the truck empty from Mountain Home to Bliss, which the truck would be empty and in compliance with the law. But if on testimony, and you know, you don't want to go in there and lie, you know, you have to be able to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And on cross-examination, you can rest assured, you know, that the prosecutor now is going to be probing for all of the weak points in your testimony. So we have to be clean as a hound's tooth. So before we closed the door, we took pictures. Now, this is before video. So we were using a Polaroid land camera, and we took pictures of the inside of the truck empty, closed it, locked it, and then put the key in the hands of the lead witness in the chase car. We had a chase car now with three witnesses in it. This is, by the way, what we do, you know, in a Rosa Parks case when you want to test the law. You can rest assured that there were witnesses on the bus watching all of this. So now we've got three witnesses in a chase car. We've got a camera taking pictures. We've got witnesses that can testify that when the truck left the dock at the plant in Boise, it was, in fact, empty. Then it proceeded southbound on the road to Mountain Home, drove through Mountain Home, did not discharge or pick up any load, and proceeded on to Bliss. Now, the truck is empty. Now, there's another problem. It's a technical problem that any truck driver would see immediately, and we presume that the police would probably see. And that is that the truck was empty by just looking at the spring shackles and the overload blocks. You see, when a truck is loaded, the bed of the truck will sit down lower and lower. The heavier the truck is, the more it sits down. And you could see by the arch in the spring and the fact that it wasn't touching the overload blocks that it was empty. Now, that being the case, as soon as somebody saw it, they might say, hey, the truck's empty, let it go. And that would then not be in our best interest. That isn't what we want to do here. That's like saying, Rosa Parks, you can go ahead and ride the front of the bus. We don't want that. We need to have a damage here. You have to get arrested. You have to get ticketed. You have to get jailed. There has to be a vital controversy at issue. Remember, we have to comply now with the TVA case. Now, with that in mind, we stopped at the bottom of Kings Hill and let the air out of the tires. This then made the truck appear to be loaded because the tires were flat on the bottom. Now, you know, you've got to be careful. We can't be running on flat tires, but by the same token, you can't have these tires, you know, fully round. So then there's a slight incline going up the hill to the weigh station. It's a four-lane freeway, but it's on an incline. So I shifted into fifth over at about 30 miles an hour, and the truck starts to jerk a little bit. See, so as I'm passing the scale, The tires are low, and the truck is jerking. It's driving slow, which would make you think, it would give you the impression that this truck is so heavy, so loaded, that it should be stopping, clearing, entering, paying duties in the port of entry. Now, at the same time that I'm driving by here, we have to be careful that there isn't a truck on the scale. This is a worry to us also, because if there's a truck on the scale, I could drive by and the weighmaster in the scale shack wouldn't even see me because there's a truck on the scale blocking his view. So as I was coming up the hill, I gauged my speed and the number of trucks that are in the line waiting, so that as a truck was pulling off the scale, I speeded up, shifted over, and then as I went by, I was between the two trucks so that the weighmaster would have a clear view of my truck as it was going by. You know, much the same way we would have to have a clear view of a black woman sitting in a seat on the front of the bus. We're not trying to hide this, you know, we're getting right out here in the open. Now, remember, there were times when the waymaster was just lazy and wouldn't send anybody out to pick me up. So to make sure that we've got some adrenaline flowing in the policeman inside the scale shack, as we went by, I gave him that famous international flag of distress. Boy, that did it. That raised his adrenaline. And at milepost 381, here comes Officer Mogenden out. Same guy, same time, same station. And then so Officer Mogenden stopped me, and he gave me a ticket again. All right, now we've got our damage, don't we? It's what we needed, it's what we got. And, of course, he asked me why we didn't stop at the scale. And this time, I didn't tell him. I didn't tell him Article 1, Section 9. I didn't tell him, you know, go to hell or jump up and down or anything. I changed my modus operandi here, and I said, I want to reserve all of my rights at all times, and I don't want to waive any of my rights at any time for any cause or reason. And I'm going to remain silent. Now, the policeman has certain criteria that he has to fulfill. So he's going to say, well, where's your license? I presented it. He said, where's your registration? I presented it. And he said, where's your insurance? And I presented it. But I didn't talk. I didn't tell him, you know, gee, what a nice day it is. How's the wife and the kids? And we're not here in conversation. This is a business transaction. This is a legal business transaction. Now, anything that I say can and will be used against me in court. So, in answer to, well, why didn't you stop back at the scale? I'm not going to answer. I don't want to tell him why. Well, because the truck is empty and I'm testing a legal issue. Rosa Parks did not say, hey, listen, we're testing this Alabama statute and we're here to find out whether you will arrest us or not and blah, blah, blah. This is why the goat in cases like this, when you're making legal tests, you know, has to be somebody that's knowledgeable and has some, you know, has some moxie between their ears. All right, now the legal issue is clearly set. We've been damaged, truck's empty. But the officer said, I'm going to order you to go back to the scale and weigh the truck. So he said, follow me. Now, I followed him up to Bliss. We crossed over the freeway. We crossed back down, went down the other side of the road, came to a crossover, and the policeman now, Officer Mogan, and now he's got a backup man that shows up on the scene. This is quite common. After the policeman stops you, he'll call in and another policeman comes, and he gets behind you. Sometimes it's a supervisor. Sometimes it's just another guy, And so now I got one in front of me and one behind me. Now, as we go off the road and cross over, and as we're approaching the scale shack for the second time now, Officer Mogenden is leading me straight onto the scale. Now, there's no line of trucks now. They've passed, and there's just the policeman going forward. He goes across the scale. Now, as he pulls onto the scale, I turned to the right behind the scale shack into a parking place. Now, I guess Mogenden thought I was trying to escape or something, so he raced around the building and parked his car in front of my truck, which is now stopped. As I'm getting out of the truck, the other policeman is pulled up behind me. Now, they've got me blocked. I can't go forward and I can't go backward. I got out of the truck. Now, the truck door is locked. I slammed it. I've got the ignition key in my hand, and I threw the key out into the weeds, way out into a place where it was, I say weeds, you know, it was grass, and on the other side of the fence outside the way station, probably a farmer's land. And Mogenden said, "You're under arrest." I said, "Okay, I'll go quietly." And so he led me inside, and we went inside, and evidently they had called for some more police backup, because there was about, I don't know, I didn't count them all, but there was probably four or five police cars there. And there was four or five policemen, and two or three of them, they're walking around the truck, and they're looking underneath, and they're looking all around it. The truck is locked. And, of course, our three witnesses with the camera now, they're back out of the way, out of sight, out of mind, taking pictures of all of this. Now, what we're looking for here is the police violation of the law. Are they going to get the bolt cutters out and cut the lock off the door without a search warrant? Well, we don't know until we test it. In this case, they didn't, so they didn't break that law. Are they going to break into the cab of the truck? No, they didn't do that. They called Judge Becker, and I couldn't hear both sides of the conversation, but I could hear the policeman. Now, remember, it was Officer Mogenden. He's on the line. And he describes to the judge what had just happened. And he said, "It's really aberrant behavior." And so he says, we need a warrant. And I can't hear what the judge is saying. And he says, "Well, no, we didn't do that." And yes, we did that. And then he told about me getting out of the truck and didn't go across the scale, didn't weigh, threw the key out into the weeds. He said he had three officers out there looking for the key. Now, I suppose if they found the key, they might open it. They've got me under arrest. They might have to do an inventory search. Now, they can get into the cab of the truck. I can assure you there isn't anything in the cab. There's no paperwork and nothing in there. And we're watching to see if they're going to break into the truck without a warrant. That's kind of the key thing that we're looking at here. Now, you can imagine how suspicious this looks. Is this truck loaded with marijuana? Has it got drugs and guns or something in there? It certainly does look strange, doesn't it? Especially since they just got through prosecuting me successfully, just a month before. So, in the final analysis, they could not get a search warrant. Now, I'm under arrest. I guess I'm going to go to jail. But in the final analysis, after they failed to get a search warrant from the judge, they decided to give me a ticket and then sent me on my way. Now, my plant superintendent had the key to the lock on the back of the truck, and he also had another ignition key. See, I couldn't carry a second ignition key in my pocket, because under arrest they're going to search and then they'd find that key, wouldn't they? So I can't have the key to the truck, inside or out. And so after it was over, I simply walked back and talked to these three guys in this car, got the key and got in the truck, and went on up to Bliss, turned around, went back to Boise. Now, we have succeeded in getting the issue set for trial, haven't we? And that's the essential elements to a Rosa Parks or to any kind of case that you want to set. It's got to be set for trial. You're trying to get the police to act. Now, in this case, the police have acted incorrectly. They've stopped a truck. They do not know if it's loaded or empty. And it had to have been loaded, and it had to have been loaded with something on the list. But they didn't break in. They didn't beat me up. They didn't get overzealous and commit false arrest and false imprisonment. And after all, now, this is not a false arrest because the police were acting at the time on what appeared to be reasonable suspicion under the Terry rule. I mean, you know, this guy is acting kind of strange. I gave him my license and insurance and registration. In other words, I fulfilled all of my duties, and he fulfilled all of his duties. And in the final analysis, he said, okay, I'm going to write you a ticket, and you can go. So we don't have any complaints. Officer Mogenden did his job perfectly. They did not break into the truck. Everybody there acted perfectly. Now, there's an issue, though. There's a legal issue. Do I or do I not have a duty to stop, enter, clear, and pay duty in that port of entry? Now, my position is, no, I don't. Now, from the position of the police, they're sitting there saying, well, there's a sign down the road here, and it says all trucks exit next right. And I'm a truck, and I did not exit next right. So we're going to test that sign. Does that sign down there that says all trucks exit next right have any legal meaning or substance? Or is it merely advisory, like slow to 35? You're in a speed zone that's, say, 65 miles an hour, but there is an advisory sign that says 35. It doesn't say slow to 35. It just has an arrow, and it says 35. That's called an advisory sign. Speed limit's still 65. Now, whether or not your car can negotiate this turn at 65 may be a physics question, but it's not a legal question. All right, now with that much in mind, let me pause right here and give you your reminder. It's the halfway point in the program here. I have to remind you that you are listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling and asking for it. The number to call is 417-273-4967. Now, again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Click on to the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there, georgegordon.org. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors and publications that we're endorsing and recommending are necessarily going to endorse and recommend the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the sting stories. In the last program, I pointed out that we had our first encounter testing Article 1, Section 9, and Judge Becker pointed out that that's the wrong legal question to be applied to these facts. Now, once the judge showed me how to code plead this statute, I recognized the error of my ways, and this is why I've pointed out that when somebody has a legal issue, you know, the first thing you need to do is to decide, are you innocent or guilty based upon code pleading the statute? It may well be that you're guilty, in which case you're going to ultimately lose. So just because you lose does not mean that the judge is a commie pinko fag. It means that you didn't plead the case correctly. As I've pointed out earlier, in Reynolds versus U.S., the Supreme Court came back, as did every other court, and said, Reynolds, you're guilty. Now, pundits have been saying, well, it's because of the religious bigotry of the Supreme Court and their bias against Mormons that they came to this conclusion. That's not the case at all. Reynolds failed to plead his case correctly, and as a result of that, he was found guilty. And so oftentimes, you can be innocent. You can have the winning case. But you lose because you pled it incorrectly. So in the last program I showed you, the judge explained to me very patiently. He said, you mispled your case. And because you didn't plead your case correctly, you're going to be found guilty. And that's why the judge, you know, when he came in, he says, God, I wish I had this case. I'd win it in 5 minutes. He wasn't whistling Dixie. Now the judge told me how to win the case. Let's see if I can win the case in 5 minutes. Now, this case is set for arraignment. So when I came into arraignment, the judge asks the question, how do you plead, guilty or not guilty? This is a factual question that deals with a driver with a driver's license. This is not the time for a demur. This is not the time to amend the complaint. This is the time to plead guilty or not guilty. After all, I'm a soldier in the Army, as evidenced by my driver's license. Not guilty is the correct plea. So I pled not guilty. Now, the case is set for trial. Before trial, we have pre-trial motions. So I filed a motion to dismiss for failure of the state to prove its prima facie case. And I filed a motion to waive jury trial. Now, I filed some other procedural motions along with it. And so when we came into the motion hearing, the prosecutor is there, and I subpoenaed as witnesses for the defense at the motion hearing Officer Mogenden, the Waymaster, and one of the backup policemen, the one that was in the car directly behind me. The three other backup guys that came in, I don't need them. At the mouth of two witnesses or at the mouth of three witnesses shall the matter be established. I have three witnesses in my chase car, but I also have three witnesses from the government. And I'm going to use the government witnesses first before I rely upon my witnesses. So, it's my motion hearing, so I go first. And I brought up the ordinary issues like the jury trial and the procedural motions, which were ruled on. And then I had saved the key issue, that is, the motion to dismiss. Now, this is a misdemeanor. In a felony, we're entitled to a preliminary hearing. Now, I styled this as a preliminary hearing because a preliminary hearing is for the purposes of determining whether or not a crime has been committed. Now, when you plead not guilty, you admit that a crime has been committed, but that you deny that you're the criminal who committed this wrongful act. That's the legal effect of not guilty. Now, in this case, I'm admitting that a crime has been committed, and I'm denying that I'm the person who committed the crime. But I need a preliminary hearing to determine whether or not the state has a case to bring to trial. It's my position that they don't even have a case to bring to trial. But I have to be able to show that. After all, the government's entitled to notice and opportunity to defend. They're entitled to their day in court. So if I'm going to come in here and move to have this case dismissed, the burden of proof is on me. So I go first with my burden of proof. So I started off by calling in Officer Mogenden as my first witness. And he got on the witness stand, and I asked him 25 questions. The first 10 questions deal with what we call foundation. So I laid the foundation and proved that he was competent to testify to the following 15 questions. Then I asked about 8 questions dealing with the essentials of the stop. And the question number 18 was what we call the ringer. And question 18 asked Officer Mogenden, what was the truck loaded with? And he said, I don't know. And then I said, why not? Didn't you get a search warrant? Well, we tried to, but we couldn't. Did you break into the truck? No, we didn't. So you couldn't get a search warrant? No, we couldn't. So you don't know what the truck is loaded with? No, I don't. You don't even know whether the truck is loaded or not, do you? No, I do not. And then question 25, and he was excused. So I brought the backup man in, and I asked him the same 25 questions. Question 18, what was the truck loaded with? Well, then, you don't know whether the truck was loaded or empty, do you? No. No. And when I finished with him, I brought in the weighmaster. Weighmaster, do you know what the truck was loaded with? No. Was the truck loaded? I don't know. Was the truck empty? I don't know. So when we finished with those three witnesses, remember, at the mouth of two witnesses or at the mouth of three witnesses shall the matter be established, we don't go beyond three witnesses. Now, I've got three more witnesses who can testify to all kinds of neat stuff, you know, such as where did the truck come from? It was Boise. Was the truck empty when it left Boise? Did it pick up a load in Mountain Home? Did it pick up a load along the way? Did it drop a load? I mean, I've got all kinds of testimony to give in my defense. But for the purposes of qualifying the case for trial, have I done enough to get the case dismissed? And the answer is, well, yes, I have. Remember, the government's burden is to prove that the truck is loaded. That's number one. And they have to prove that it's loaded with something that's on that list of 40 items. And the witnesses here haven't been able to testify to that. So, at that point in time, I rested my case. And the judge then chimed in and he said, now, Mr. Gordon, when this case goes to trial, are you going to bring in any expert witnesses? Are you going to bring in any witnesses to testify in addition to the facts that we've heard here today? And do you have any scientific evidence? Do you have any pictures, diagrams? forensic evidence or anything like that? And I said, yes, yes, yes to all of the above. I've got more evidence to produce, but I think that I've produced all the evidence that's relevant for the court to make its decision on this motion to dismiss. So then the judge turns to the prosecutor. It's his turn. He says, now, are you prepared to put on your witnesses? And the prosecutor said, well, the witnesses that I'm going to produce at trial are the same three witnesses that Mr. Gordon has already produced. And the testimony that has already been produced is essentially the same testimony that I'm going to present at trial. So the judge asked him, he said, well, do you have any photographs? No. Have you got any forensic evidence? No. Got any scientific tests or expert witnesses? No. And the judge said, well, based upon what we have heard here today, when we go to trial, is this essentially the state's case? And he said, yes. So Judge Becker paused for a little effect. Now, this particular courtroom is the small courtroom. Now, remember, there's in most courthouses, they'll have a big courtroom. That's for conducting trials where there's a lot of people and a lot of public interest. And then you have the little courtroom where we go in when we just have some procedural matter to take up, like motions and things, and the public isn't there. And so there's probably room for, I'm going to guess 15 or 20 people in the room. It's been a long time ago. I can't tell you exactly how many. It wasn't over 30 in there, and I'm going to guess 15 or 20. And I was kind of surprised on this day because I was there, of course, with three of my witnesses and myself, and Steve Gibson was there as my counsel, of course. And then there were some of the Idaho Patriots that were there, so I'm going to guess that there was probably five or six other people there. Probably 10 people in the courtroom were on my side. They were there to observe me, and they were my cheering section and so on. And then the other half that were there, in fact, it was about twice as many, about 2-1. In fact, all the seats were taken, and there were probably six or eight people standing up in the back of the courtroom. And I noted that these people were wearing suits. And I said to myself, looks like to me that these people dressed in suits back here are lawyers, maybe highway patrolmen, maybe Department of Transportation, I'm sure that from their point of view, they were saying, what in the hell is going on here? They must have been asking, this guy runs the scale, and we prosecute him and convict him, then he comes back and runs the scale again. And it's an unusual event because as he goes by, he gives the weighmaster the finger. And police aren't stupid, They're sitting there saying, we don't know exactly what's going on here, but we can see that this is definitely abnormal. This is not the ordinary and usual behavior of the Joe Sixpack truck drivers that are driving up and down the highways of Idaho. And I would be the first one to say, yay, Lord. So the judge, after, maybe 5 seconds, he said, well, based upon all of the evidence that's been presented here at the preliminary hearing, my conclusion is the state does not have a prima facie case, and accordingly, the decision of the court is to dismiss without prejudice. Now, that's an important statement. When a judge says, I'm going to dismiss without prejudice, he leaves the door open for the government to clean up its act. He's saying to them, at this moment in time, you haven't got a case to bring to trial. If you can go back and get your case cleaned up, you can come back again and charge Mr. Gordon again for the same offense, and it won't be double jeopardy. Then we'll go forward and listen to your evidence and see whether you've got a case. Now, if the judge were to dismiss with prejudice, now that's another signal. And it says, you can't bring this case again. you're barred here. And if you want to continue on with this case, you're going to have to take it up with the Court of Appeals. So when you hear the words, I dismiss without prejudice, or I dismiss with prejudice, the judge is giving you a clue. And oftentimes what goes on in the courtroom is done in code. That's why this is called code pleading. And that's because law is written in code. It's not written for the lay people to understand. It's written for the professionals. It's written for judges and lawyers. It is not written for defendants. It's not written for jurors. The law is a mystery. And it's designed that way. And there's a reason for that. If everybody knew what the law was, and if everybody practiced the law, well, then we would lose a vital economic resource in our community. You see, the judicial system raises tremendous amounts of revenue. It's another way to tax people. That's why we have these fines. If you think it's there to correct people and to get these people to change their behavior, it is true that it does have some effect along those lines, but that is not the primary purpose behind the judicial system, at least the civil judicial system, the civil law judicial system. It's a taxing system, and to show you how that worked, I was in court one time, and there was a judge by the name of Woods. He's a Mormon fellow, kind of a Jack Mormon, as I recall. And we were doing a jury trial on driving without a license. And the judge said to me, we were on break, and we were out in the lobby, and the judge kind of ambled over to me, and he said, well, Mr. Gordon, he commended me about the good job I was doing presenting my case. Because by now I had a little more experience, you know, and I was doing a little more professional jobs. So anyway, he said to me, he said, do you know how much it costs to put on a one-day jury trial here in the traffic court? And I said, no, I don't. And he said, well, it's $1,200. And I was really surprised. I had no idea how much it cost. And when he said it cost $1,200 to put on a one-day trial, I was surprised on two grounds. Number one, the maximum fine in this case was $300, and while it could have jail time, there wasn't any jail time that was in the offing in this case, you know, on other grounds. And so I thought, why in the world is this judge prosecuting me and spending $1,200, and the maximum fine that he's going to get out of me is going to be $300, and he's not even going to get the $300 fine out of me, you know, on other grounds, which is beyond the scope of what we're discussing here today. I'm not suggesting to you now that you don't pay your fines. I'm just telling you that in this particular case, that fine couldn't be imposed. So he's going to spend $1,200 of taxpayer money, go through all these ropes. He could have dismissed. He didn't. And we're going to go through this, and when we get all through, he's going to find me guilty. He's not going to get his $300. I wondered what this was all about. And so the judge looked at me, and he said, doesn't that bother you? And I said to him, does it bother you? And he said, you damn right it bothers me. I'm a taxpayer. And to spend $1,200 on this trial that we both know is totally unnecessary bothers me. And I said, well, Judge, if this bothers you, let's go in and you dismiss. And he said, well, I can't dismiss. And I said, Judge, I did not bring this action here. I did not complain about your behavior or about the prosecutor's behavior. It's the prosecutor who has brought me in here. It is the government that is complaining about my behavior. I'm not the cause of this trial. And I said, if this bothers you, you should go in and dismiss. I don't have any power to dismiss. And now remember, the judges asked me, you know, does this bother you? And I said, no. And I said, furthermore, any case that is important enough for the government to prosecute is important enough for me to defend. Now, the judge was kind of surprised at that. And he kind of sighed a little bit and he said, well, okay, let's get on with it. And so we went on back inside and we went ahead and completed the case, to which the judge duly found me guilty. And then I duly didn't pay the fine. And then we both went our separate ways, and we go on to the next round and the next round and the next round. Now, the government does this because the government has a program, and this program deals with taxation. And in Boise, that is in Ada County, 10% of the city of Boise budget is dependent upon these fines that come out of the traffic court. If everybody obeyed all the laws all the time, the city budget would be in deficit by 10%. It's a taxing system, and they depend upon this taxing system. No, I didn't make it that way. We're not here because we're interested in the health, safety, and welfare of the public. We're interested in the economic and the fiscal health and vitality of the city of Boise. So I want to point that out to you so that you can understand, you know, what the motivation is. It is true that it may have some deterrent effect on some people, but that's not the primary purpose of this exercise. Now, going back to the courtroom here in Gooding, to bring you up to speed again. Now, the judge has just dismissed me, and I turned around to look at my plant supervisor, Rick Hosveit, who was in the first row. And as I looked, we made eye contact, and he raised his two hands with the thumbs up, like, hey, we did it. Thumbs up. But I looked beyond Rick, and I'm telling you, you could have heard a pin drop in the courtroom. It just absolutely was stunned silence. The three policemen were just sitting there staring ahead like, what in the hell just happened here? I think in the minds of most of the people there on the other side, they must have been saying, how much did he pay that judge? How much did he bribe that judge to get that decision? Boys and girls, there was no bribe. The judge had already told me that anybody that can come in here and argue this case correctly, I'm going to cut him loose. He told me that he had testified before the Transportation Committee, before the Supreme Court. Not testified before the Supreme Court. Now, in Idaho, they only had, that at that time, they had 79 judges, and they had two judicial conferences a year, and so naturally Judge Becker would be at the judicial conferences, and they talk about the legal problems that judges have, deciding the laws and construing the statutes and one thing another, and he'd brought it up to the Supreme Court, and he said this needs to be corrected. It's written incorrectly, needs to be clarified. It's vague and ambiguous. Now, we call that constitutionally vague and ambiguous, and Now, most people don't know how to argue it, and so they just go in and plead guilty. Now, I don't know how many people walk in there on 29-27 to plead guilty and pay their fines. Probably 99.999%. Once in a while, some guy comes in, pleads not guilty, and then he's promptly found guilty and then pays his fine and goes down the road. But I was the first guy that could walk in and argue it correctly, and it wasn't because I was so smart. It was because the judge explained it to me. Now, again, you know, you hear me tell you from time to time, I say, you know, we should be listening more to our judges and less to our politicians. It's the politicians that create these laws. And about 75% of the laws on the books are constitutionally vague and ambiguous or have a constitutional defect. Now, nobody challenges those laws, and so it doesn't make any difference that they're defective. But, you know, if you knew how to go argue that issue, if you knew how to get yourself on the right side of the issue, if you could code plead it out so that you're not coming in here guilty of breaking the law. And I tell my students very plainly when they come in here, the trick to all of this is we have to obey all of the laws all of the time. We, Hebrews, who practice the Mosaic law, we have to practice all of the law of the United States and all of the law of our states and all of the law of God, and we have to do it all perfectly all of the time. Now, it's difficult, not impossible, just difficult. Now, in Acts 5, verse 29, God tells us very plainly that we ought to obey God rather than men. Boys and girls, the Congress of the United States has told you the same thing in Public Law 97-280. The First Amendment to our Constitution, our Supreme Court in Seeger versus United States have all said the same thing. We ought to obey God rather than men. So when you hear me tell you that the census is illegal, it's a criminal activity, it violates the law of God, and we ought not to participate in it. I'm not whistling Dixie. Now, for most of you people out there, you Catholics and Protestants and Jews, you should participate in the census. You are contracted to participate. Most of you people out there who have Social Security numbers should pay your income tax. You should pay your Social Security. You should file your tax returns. You've agreed to, albeit it's an adhesion contract, and albeit it's probably unethical. It is a fraud. It is unethical. But for the most part, you people don't know how to argue it anyway. Now, unless you can argue it, you can't win. So you might as well sit down, shut up, fold your hands, and do what you're told. Now, for those of us who want to obey God and keep His commandments, I'm not an anarchist. I'm not sitting here telling you people that you should become tax protesters. I'm telling you the income tax is a criminal activity. It's a counterfeit of tithing. You should be paying your tithe pursuant to the tithing statute in Malachi 3. You should not be paying income tax. But, you know, if you've contracted into the income tax, which most of you have, then remember Jesus said you should render unto Caesar those things which are Caesar's. And the income tax surely belongs to Caesar. But you ought not to be rendering to Caesar. You ought to be rendering to God. And you don't owe the tax and the tithe. You owe one or the other, but not both. So either pay the God of the United States or pay the God of creation. How's that for a plan? All right, there's that story. Now, I'm out of time. I got to give you a reminder here that you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives that can all be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.